there is no first class on a lifeboat. In 1940, the German submarines, the notorious U-boats, patrol the English Channel between Britain and France. They block the transport of food and ammunition. They also stand in the way of ocean liners traveling between Europe and the U.S. In 1944, a British filmmaker working in the U.S. by the name of Alfred Hitchcock drops a gem of a film. Hitchcock wasn't hired for the propaganda effort. As such, he doesn't have access to troops, military planes, or boats. How do you make a war movie in the middle of a war without showing the actual war? Life is much easier when you're a genius. This is a rather unusual Tor's Cabinet episode. It's the second of two episodes after the Belzoni one last week that were written for me by the incomparable Claire Dissot, who is also a published cookbook author, and it's about two things I like a lot too, food and Hitchcock movies. Hitchcock had a penchant for movies in constrained settings. Probably the most famous is Rear Window. One of my favorite movies ever is his movie Rope, 1948, which unfolds over 80 minutes of real time in a New York apartment, meant to look like it's all shot in a single take, which wasn't technologically possible at that point. This is about another movie like that. This one's quite a bit more speculative than most episodes I've done. When I initially saw the script, I thought it was much too The Curtains Were Blue, but as I've read through it again, I'm more convinced that Claire is right, that she's picked up what the screenwriter was putting down. And whether or not she is, it's a damn good story. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian and Thimble the Doll, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Lifeboat, Hitchcock's 1944 movie, starts as the ship sinks. An ocean liner on its way from New York was hit by a German torpedo. It has, however, been slightly luckier than the Titanic or the Lusitania. It's daytime on a fine summer day, and there are plenty of lifeboats. We are seated in one of these lifeboats for the duration of the whole film. On board, we meet a sampling of the American society of the time, men and women of all walks of life. Joe, the only black man present, was a steward on the ship, so he gets to take care of the food. He wasn't asked to, he was told to. Soon, tensions flare up. Rittenhouse, a wealthy ship owner back home, proclaims himself captain of this raft. This doesn't sit well with Kovac, a loudmouthed fellow from the Chicago meatpacking district. Kovac remarks on every mistake Rittenhouse makes, and he makes plenty. Soon, Kovac, by popular demand, replaces Rittenhouse as captain. There's a lot happening every few minutes. Our castaways are starting to feel the hot weather, the cabin fever, and the lack of proper rations, eating mostly hard sea biscuits. Tempers get volatile. Then, they spot a man overboard. They pick him up. A rotund, red-haired, and red-bearded man in his 30s is hauled onto the deck. At a glance, the newcomer seems a welcome addition to the party. He's appropriately grateful. He's willing to row and appears to be a better sailor than the whole rest of the company combined. There's only one slight problem. He's German. Willie was an officer on the U-boat that torpedoed the ocean liner. Then, an Allied warship returned the pleasantry, and the submarine is presently swimming with the fishes. So now, there's one more mouth to feed. And, judging by Willie's prominent waistline, that's a job and a half. As days pass, despite Joe the steward's best efforts, hunger is settling in. That is when Hitchcock and his screenwriter, celebrated playwright Ben Hecht, shoehorn an apparently unimportant scene. Rittenhouse, the former captain, Kovac, the loudmouthed Chicagoan, and Willie the German start talking about food. On the face of it, there's nothing remarkable here. Our guys are hungry, so they talk about food. But how they talk about food is rather distinctive. You read enough survival diaries, you come to expect imaginary steak dinners, roast potatoes, grandma's cherry pies. Those are there, but they're mostly not talking about food itself. They're talking about restaurants. That calls for some digging, and digging reveals an astounding tale of America's battles for its fundamental freedoms. Each restaurant, named in the dialogue, stands for a pillar of the American experiment. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of a ribeye steak. Now that's how you make propaganda. Rittenhouse opens with a bold claim. In the old days, there was a place in Boston, Young's Hotel. It had the best restaurant in the world. Let's unpack this a bit. Restaurants, as we know them, independent establishments whose main focus is food, only started appearing in the US around the middle of the 19th century. Until then, if you had to eat outside the home, as a wealthy person in a big city, you would book a table at the restaurant of one of the fine hotels in town. To this day, in some English-speaking countries, or rather countries that speak English as a second language, hotel means restaurant. You go to the south of India and people advertise hotel all over the place. Don't have any beds. They're restaurants. The rest of us would go to a bar or a saloon. Some places on the Gold Rush Trail even had a free all-you-can-eat buffet, rich in very salty dishes to encourage drinking, because that's where the real money was. But our Mr. Rittenhouse belongs to the elite. In Boston, the restaurant at Young's Hotel was the jewel in the hospitality crown. Food was French, or some interpretation of it, because that's what fine dining was, as I talked about in my British food episode. The lighting was electric, which was crazy modern. The restaurant boasted a main dining room seating 150. There were also ladies-only and gentlemen-only dining rooms. You could sit at the lunch counter, or prefer the oyster bar. Huge doesn't begin to cover it. They even printed their own currency. Young's opened in 1860. Until it closed in 1927, it housed the private dinners of political operatives, business guilds, and student bodies. It became the headquarters of Harvard students' poker nights. Their VIP list was as long as their lunch counter. So, let's take a closer look at that VIP list. Right at the top, we notice a few luminaries who seem to have something in common. Mark Twain, the universally acclaimed writer, was one of the funniest, wittiest writers who ever lived. But he didn't stop at writing, and he didn't stop at funny. He campaigned for the abolition of slavery, famously saying that Lincoln's proclamation not only set the black slaves free, but set the white man free also. Twain paid out of pocket for the college tuition of black students. Dining at Young's, Mark Twain could well have been eating next to Senator Charles Sumner. A major figure of his time, the gentleman from Massachusetts conducted the abolition campaign for President Lincoln. He had a fierce tongue, too, and that almost got him killed. In the middle of a Congress session, Sumner accused a South Carolina senator of wanting slavery to continue so he could sexually assault his slaves. That South Carolina senator had a nephew, a congressman, who disagreed. The nephew took out the closest thing he had to a weapon on hand, his walking cane, and caned Sumner to within an inch of his life, right there on the Congress floor. Sumner spent 3 years, yes, 3 years, in hospital. The minute he was out, he started campaigning again. Senator Sumner would have known our next guest very well. Lloyd Garrison was the editor-in-chief of the abolitionist newspaper The Liberator. Garrison founded the Anti-Slavery American Association. He also ardently campaigned for women's rights. Speaking of which, the last VIP at our table is Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Don't let the sweet grandma picture fool you. This lady was a dragon. She made a name for herself when she campaigned for abolition of slavery. As such, she was well respected. Stanton's reputation took a downturn when she added women to her cause. She argued women should be given the right to vote at the same time as black men. Too soon, Elizabeth. Too soon. So, Young's Hotel pretty much stands for abolition of slavery and women's rights. Am I reading too much into a simple line of dialogue? Rittenhouse looking for the
Young's Hotel had the best restaurant in the world.
Meaning, in the US, to him, could have named Delmonico's in New York or the Willard in Washington. The grand dining rooms, the superlative menu, the elegant company would have been comparable, but neither had that guest list, that unique standing in the combat for human rights. And as the dialogue on board the lifeboat keeps going, there's less and less doubting the writer's intentions. To Rittenhouse claiming Young's restaurant for himself, Kovac replies,
"But it wasn't any better than Henrici's Coffee House in Chicago, or Bookbinder's in Philly."
To the 1940s American foodies, and I'm sure there was such a thing, watching the movie, it must have seemed Kovac didn't know what he was talking about. Henrici's was all about family dining at affordable prices. It was a good restaurant, not a refined one. Henrici's served mostly roasted meats, some fried fish, a selection of omelets. The prices were low, and there was no orchestra. But Henrici stood out for a different reason. The waiters were all women. That must have been part of the attraction for Kovac, whose tattooed torso displays a flurry of women's initials. Perhaps he just thinks of it as World War II-era Hooters. It certainly brought in customers. It also may have helped to keep the prices low, as women were paid less than men for the same job, officially in those days. However, in 1911, that marketing stunt turned around and bit the restaurant in the wallet. The waitresses are on strike. What do they want? They want a 10-hour workday and a 6-day work week. Who knows how long they worked before? The management appears to give in as business resumes as usual. But 3 years later, the waitresses are at it again. They now strike for the legalization of the waitresses' union, as well as a salary of $8 per week. They picket in front of the restaurant, shouting slogans, handing out leaflets. 35 restaurants in Chicago are hit by the strike, but Henrici's, being so popular and employing so many staff, focuses the ire of the movement. The police intervenes to escort diners to their tables. Picketing waitresses are harassed by agents from Pinkerton's, a private for-hire police force. Some get arrested. The movement garners solid popular support. It stands to reason that the strike would have notable legal consequences. The court pronounces the curtailing of the right to demonstrate in public. Too soon, ladies. Too soon. Now, if you've been in Philadelphia any time between 1893 and 2009, you may have eaten at Bookbinders, the other restaurant Kovac mentions. Bookbinders was the city's oldest seafood establishment. Already a staple of Philadelphia's food scene, Bookbinders' notoriety explodes in 1943 when the U.S. joins World War II. The restaurant stands literally next door to the enlistment offices. As future soldiers line up, Bookbinders supports the war effort by handing them free meals. Yet the place always felt it was etched into the DNA of the nation's history. You can tell by the stained glass portraits of early American presidents lining the walls, and the plaque at the entrance. 271 words. That's long for a plaque, but really short for a speech, particularly a speech as impactful. Lincoln's Gettysburg Address reaffirms the tenets of the Declaration of Independence. Humans are equal, freedom is a right, governing should be by the people, for the people. Bookbinders lifts all doubts. Restaurants in U.S. history stand for much more than what's on the menu. But then Kovac seems to realize that he's left the fight for civil rights to Rittenhouse, so he doubles down.
Ever eat in Antoine's in New Orleans?
If you haven't, you probably should, because it's still there, and it's a sight to behold. Antoine's opened its doors in 1840. Founded by a Frenchman, the place wows the fine people of New Orleans with its 15 rooms, each with their own theme, each lavishly decorated. You wouldn't find any place like it, not in the Big Easy, not anywhere at the time. Of all the restaurants named in the film, Antoine's is the only one that opened before the Civil War, and it's the only one south of the Mason-Dixon line. As such, it seems to speak for the proponents of slavery. Could Kovac be against abolition? Not so fast. Take a look at a map of the restaurant. What you're looking at is really a map of 100 years of history. You have the Capitol Room. It features woodwork salvaged from the original capital of Louisiana in Baton Rouge. A Civil War casualty, the building was destroyed in 1862 while Union troops were occupying the building. Apparently, they did nothing to extinguish a fire in the northwest turret. There's no clear story on how Antoine's got a hold of the woodwork, but if you told me they'd picked it from a fuming pile of ashes, I wouldn't disbelieve it. If you told me they had just claimed to have gotten their hands on the woodwork, wouldn't disbelieve that either. At Antoine's during the Prohibition years, if you whispered to the waiter, "It's a mystery to me," you would be taken through a hidden passage to a secret room. The scarlet-painted mystery room harbored patrons eager to imbibe far, but not too far, from the prying eyes of the law. Booze was served in coffee cups. Even earlier, at the turn of the century, Antoine's had opened the Japanese Room to surf the Orientalist wave. The room was shut off when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. It did reopen some 43 years later, with not a hint of Japanese styling in sight. Interestingly, Kovac didn't pick the first unsegregated restaurant down south. He's talking less about how things are and more about the road to get there. The fights, the victories and defeats, the building process. Senators get caned, waitresses get jailed, harbors get bombed, capitals get destroyed. Equality is a fight, it takes time, and it's not for the meek. but equality is a principle upon which America stands, a principle for which it fights. That fight has gotten our heroes torpedoed in the middle of the ocean. Equality is a principle they now have to uphold as they interact with one another, and it's being tested when their lifeboat becomes home to an enemy officer. Because Willie, the German, won't be left out of this conversation. Amid the fine East Coast eateries, he drops,
"In Munich, there is a place called Lorbers. Their specialty is pot roast."
Pot roast.
Their specialty is pot roast. Pot roast. Rittenhouse has only scorn for such simple fare. Willie doesn't even rate a look of support from Kovac, the supposed man of the people. But what if we applied to his Munich restaurant the same scrutiny we gave the others? In the name of, you know, equality. Munich has an interesting history with restaurants, particularly with its breweries. These are inns serving simple food alongside enough beer to sink a submarine. It is in one of these Munich breweries in 1923 that Adolf Hitler prepares and fails an attempted coup inspired by the coup in Italy that led to Mussolini taking power. 16 years later, in that very same brewery, a man named Georg Elser would attempt and fail to assassinate Hitler. And on the side of the Allies, the first spectators of Lifeboat, at the mention of Munich, they would immediately think of the attempted and failed peace treaty of 1938. The Munich Agreement was the last chance compromise between Chamberlain, Daladier, Hitler, and Mussolini. But then, what exactly is Willie saying here? Are peace, democracy, and dictatorship all equally condemned to fail? That would be forgetting what's for dinner. First off, Lorber, another traditional beer hall still open today, that's not where the putsch and assassination attempts took place. That would be the Bürgerbraukeller. Willie, of course, knows that. Every German of the time knows that. Willie chose a different establishment. In other words, Willie is neither supporting the Reich nor siding with the resistance. He's an average German who likes pot roast. And that's a big deal, because you see, during World War II, not all Germans, not even all German officers, were of the mustachioed persuasion. You had the card-carrying Adolf fan club, and then you had the regular German army, with regular guys dedicated at least partially to doing their job. Are they the baddies? Doesn't matter to them. Willie's a regular guy. An enemy for sure. Not a criminal. It may seem kind of a weak message compared to the other establishments we visited in the conversation. It mattered much more back in the day, when Germany as a nation was summarily painted with a fascist brush. The Germans love their children too. Also, their pot roast. But Willie's quip reaches further still. Look at the menu. On Lorber's menu, the pot roast does get pride of place. But until COVID hit and the restaurant was sold to a nice young family offering the occasional fitness salad, Lorber's pot roast did not appear under its German name of Sauerbraten, nor under its German recipe cooked in wine with veggies. Instead, Lorber's menu featured Svikova. That's the Czech version of pot roast served with bread dumplings and cranberry sauce. Why? I mean, present-day Czechia was once part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the two nations share strong cultural markers. Large parts of modern-day Czechia were majority German, as recent as World War II. But isn't it just a bit strange to pick, among all the traditional inns in Munich, the one that does not serve the national German recipe? Take a country, any country that doesn't prohibit eating beef. You can be sure to find some version of a pot roast, and more than most, the dish speaks of unity. The French pot-au-feu, garnished with marrow bones, unites families on Sundays. The Japanese nikujaga was, according to one of its origin stories, a fusion of the British pot roast and the Japanese flavors of dashi broth and rice vinegar. The Moroccan tangia is a rare dish prepared by men. They stuff it into the steam bath coals on Fridays so women can have time to go to the mosque. Pot roast is a dish with a history going back a few thousand years. When Caesar conquered Germany, his army traveled with plenty of food in the form of their own cattle. But the Roman cows didn't take well to the long road and the German weather. So Caesar's galleys cooked beef in wine and sent thousands upon thousands of amphoras to their boys, marching towards Cologne. And that, legend claims, is how pot roast was born. Pot roast is universal. It abolishes frontiers. Men and women of all countries, unite and pass the bread, won't you please? Equality is universal. No country, however democratic, can claim it as its privilege. Equality doesn't stop at disregarding race, gender, or class differences. It has to include the enemy, or else it means very little. And that's how, in five lines of mundane dialogue, screenwriter Ben Hecht and director Alfred Hitchcock go through 100 years of history, a couple of wars, and a few issues as old as time. That's how half a dozen restaurants come together to remind us that equality is a fight and that it's worth fighting for, so that at the end of the day we can all sit down and enjoy dinner in peace. Even on a lifeboat.
Little question will break your bones. What puts you on your knees?